I'm Laura Vinroot-Poole. For over 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store in Charlotte, North Carolina. On this podcast, we unlock the stories of people's lives through the stories of what they wore. These aren't conversations about fashion. These are conversations about people.
Everybody wants to know her name.
Is one of the fashion world's most respected journalists. I was honored to interview the woman who's often interviewed me. I hope you enjoy learning more about Booth and her point of view on what's happening in the fashion industry today. Booth Moore, I'm so glad to see you in California.
Thanks for having me. This is so fun. It's fun to be on the other side.
Well, and it's nice to be in California when it's 70 degrees and sunny and 40 degrees and rainy in Charlotte.
Indeed, yeah. And it's Arctic freeze everywhere else.
Especially where you're from, which I think you're from New York.
I am. I grew up in New York City.
And tell me about that. What's your first fashion memory?
Oh, God. It was actually before New York. My parents are from Little Rock, Arkansas. And so that's where I was born and lived until I was 4 years old. And I was the type of kid who had a purse from, I don't know, like age maybe like, you know, 6 months and always apparently had so much stuff in it that it was like, you know, clowns coming out of a Volkswagen. And so I think, you know, fashion is something that you sort of have in your genes. And I think that that was a sign that I wasn't going to be able to let go of it.
Well, I've also read that you've described yourself as an Olympic level shopper.
I have. Yeah. I think that was a wonderful thing about growing up in New York City was there were still, you know, many, many department stores around then. And so I have memories of going to Bergdorf, you know, Delman shoes and
sort of
Victor Costa.
And oh, my
gosh. Trying on dance dresses and, you know, that kind of a thing. And then even, you know, my parents had a real affinity for Neiman Marcus coming from the South.
Yeah.
So we would take trips on the weekend out to the Neiman Marcus in White Plains as a family and, you know, shop for something for my mother or something or whatever and have lunch and popovers and all that. So that's a family memory.
And then you went down south to North Carolina for school at Duke.
I did.
What was that like? And did you have to change your wardrobe?
Not really. I mean, Duke was full of New Yorkers by then, honestly. And but I did, you know, I considered a lot of places to go to college, but really wanted sort of the sense of fun of a Southern school and also the co-ed experience because I went to all through, you know, almost 13 years of a girls' school and, you know, just kind of wanted something normal with football games and all that.
Your first job out of college was at the Washington Post?
It was, yeah. I had gotten involved in politics a bit before I graduated from Duke and was working for the Democratic National Committee and just spent a semester and a couple summers in Washington. And so I had some friends there and really wanted to move there, but also had an interest in journalism. And
Were you a journalism major?
I wasn't, no. I was a history major. But,
oh, wow.
Yeah, but then I, through a contact there, got connected to someone, this columnist of the Washington Post, who always had assistants who worked with him on a yearly basis and got to sort of learn how to write some columns and do this and that. So that was a good year-long experience at the Washington Post.
And what department were you writing with?
Metro. It was a Metro department, yeah. And so, yeah, I was doing a lot of research for his columns, which focused on, you know, Washington life. And then I got to write some columns of my own around the holidays when the Post did a big charity initiative to help families in need. So it was a great experience, but I still had this like fashion nagging at me already.
Especially in DC, I'm sure because the fashion is so bad.
Oh yeah, it was terrible at that point, and it was, you know, it was kind of soul sucking, but. But I had already worked an internship at a magazine in New York called YM, and it wasn't the greatest experience. I didn't get to do a lot of writing. The editor I was working for took off a month and asked me to check every phone number in her Rolodex. I was like, this is not the environment for me. So I knew that if I was going to do something in fashion, it was not necessarily going to be working at a magazine. So yeah, I was at the Post and I was kind of like, what am I going to do? And it was funny because Kathy Horn, who's, you know, the amazing, was a New York Times fashion critic for years and years. She was at the Post at the time and leaving to go to the New York Times. So there was actually this vacancy. Huh. And I was like all of, I don't know, 21 and a half years old. I was like, I'm going to apply for that job. So I did. But yeah, I didn't even get an interview or anything. And the person they ended up hiring, Robin Devine, yeah, is now one of my best friends.
So, oh my God, that's, yeah, so crazy.
Yeah.
And then so from the Post to LA?
No, I stopped in Vermont for a year and a half, which is where I met my husband.
Arlington?
In Arlington, Manchester. I went up there to get my stuff together and had always dreamed of moving to LA, and really in large part because of my mother and her love of 70s rock and roll and growing up on the Eagles and Linda Ronstadt and Fleetwood Mac and all those memories and just kind of wanting to be in LA. So I went to Vermont to get my stuff together to move out and started writing freelance for the local newspaper called the Manchester Journal. And my husband was the editor. Uh-huh. So my now husband. So we met and I ended up staying there for a year and covering everything from local school board meetings to snowboarding everything.
Not between. A lot of fashion to write about.
Not I'm a sure lot of Vermont. Fashion, although there were some good outlets there at the time in Manchester. Yeah,
really
but it was more sort of really just getting all the basics of news reporting experience.
And then y'all both moved to California together?
Yes.
In
a VW Rabbit.
Seriously?
Yes. With a lot of, I mean,
what color?
We sent some stuff. Red.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, one of his favorite memories is that I had this like stupid earring tree, which was like, a wood thing that you affix to the wall that had little hooks for all your earrings. And, you know, that was like the one thing that was on the top of all the mounds of stuff. And every time we stopped, it somehow like slid out and, but it managed to make it to California. I think we still have it in the garage, just some sort of like funny memory.
Did y'all have jobs when you came here?
No, we didn't.
Neither of you.
Yeah, we had saved up some absurd amount, like $1,500 or something. And we had a really fun trip across country. And then some good friends who lived here, who I'd visited and sort of found an apartment in West Hollywood, just off Sunset Boulevard, which seems to be a place that a lot of people live when they first moved to LA, at least it was in the 90s. I had a connection at the LA Times through the Washington Post, which was promising. And my husband, you know, had a journalism degree and just, you know, was a funny, good writer. And so we hoped for the best. He actually ended up being employed before I was as a TV writer in a ridiculous twist of fate where we ended up working as extras for a game show. And then, you know, my husband's very personable and he started chatting with the casting director and they said, oh, we're looking for writers. And he ended up getting hired on this game show, which was produced by DreamWorks. And he was working on the lot at NBC, like sort of within months of us arriving in LA.
Wow.
And we were still sharing the one VW Rabbit, so I would drop him off every day.
The earring tree was out.
Yeah, exactly, at NBC.
And then both got to the LA Times together?
No, I was there for a long time before he was. He was in this game show writing business for a little while. And then I eventually got to the LA Times, but I actually worked at this magazine called Bop first, which is a teen fanzine and, you know, would cover people like the Backstreet Boys and Jonathan Taylor Thomas. And my one choice memory from that was that I had the first interview with the Spice Girls.
No.
So
you interviewed them while they were here?
While they were here, they had it was their first trip to Los Angeles and they were like, you know, calling all the media to try to cover them, but they were really sort of out of nowhere. So
Bob really wanted to cover them.
Yeah. We went to Santa Monica, wrote a story about them. And it's funny because it comes full circle because when I was at the LA Times and Victoria Beckham you know, by then was a designer right. and on her own oh, and everything. And she and David moved to LA. I got the first story with her when she moved to LA, and I had a picture of myself with all the Spice Girls that I brought with me to the interview as an icebreaker, and it was hysterical.
Did it go well?
It did go
well.
She
has a great sense of humor, actually. Yeah. She's pretty funny.
She is, and she's very normal. Yeah, yeah. That was one of my favorite interviews because I met her and we met at like one office, and then we went to the Chateau for drinks, and she, you know, it's like she had the SUV downstairs that we were all piling into, and she just kind of went head first into the way back of the SUV. And I was like, this girl's cool. Yeah. I mean, she's just didn't have any errors. And then when we got to the Chateau, she ordered like the chicest thing I think I've ever
what? Heard. Oh my God.
Strawberries with balsamic.
What?
I know. I like just like fresh strawberries with balsamic
vinegar.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was delicious.
That must be a skinny girl dessert.
Secret. Exactly.
I met her. She was trying on her jeans, and we were like, how, I don't think you can breathe in these jeans. And she said, darling, breathing is so overrated.
Yes. She's
a bird.
She's hilarious. And she's incredibly disciplined.
And so from bop, how did you shift to fashion?
Well, I had interviewed at the LA Times and I was just waiting. And
for a spot to open.
For any spot. Yeah. You know, one of my philosophies about work has always been sort of find where you want to be and try to get your foot in the door.
Totally agree with that.
However you can. And so they had a part-time job open in the calendar section, which is the arts and entertainment section. I was like, well, you know, if I can get that, then I can maybe do other things there. So it took them, 6 to 8 months to finally hire me for that. And then once they did, I started freelancing fashion stories for the fashion editor there. And
did you know from the very beginning that that was what you were working towards?
Strangely enough, growing up in New York, I wasn't really aware of the fashion coverage in
women's
the
wear.
Times, for sure. example, or women's wear really. I mean, it's funny because I think fashion as an industry has changed a lot. And I wrote this book called American Runway, and it talks about sort of what changed in terms of runway shows and in terms of pop culture to make fashion sort of a more universally known about thing. And I think a lot of that happened in the, you know, late 90s and 2000s. So when I was growing up, yeah, I wasn't really aware of fashion criticism, but I pretty soon realized that I wanted to write about fashion seriously, and I didn't want to be dictated to from advertising standpoint about what I could and couldn't write. And I wanted to try to write about it in a bigger picture way and how it relates to the world around us. And that really the only place to do that was going to be a newspaper. So
and other than why I'm like never had an interest in magazines, always in that. Also, was that because of knowing Kathy and knowing Robin and seeing how it could be done? Because I think it's almost like you have to see people that are not doing what you want to do, but opening that part of your brain to see that that's even possible, like expanders, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think it's because of that. And it's also because of the fashion editor at the LA Times, Mimi Avens, who started giving me freelance opportunities. And yeah, just this ability to kind of explore journalism, but also write about fashion was what I wanted to do.
And did you love it from the first minute you did it?
Yeah. I mean, the first story I ever did for the LA Times was about Stevie Nicks style.
Oh my God.
So for, you know, coming from my mother absolutely loving her and 70s and 60s rock, and then getting that opportunity, that was amazing. And then I went to my husband and I went to the Fleetwood Mac concert at the Hollywood Bowl like a day or two after the story came out. And somebody behind us was talking about the story, which was like a dream come true. Oh. So that was a great way to start. And
amazing.
And I think, you know, obviously there have been a lot of changes in the way fashion's covered, changes in journalism in general in the last, 20 odd years that I've been doing it. So, you know, it's been sort of a lot to adjust to, but still, I think when fashion collides with, you know, politics or music or, you know, anything art, that those are the most exciting stories for me to write.
You went on to work for 17 years for the LA Times and have been called one of fashion's most respected journalists. Yeah, it's true. What was your most meaningful moment there, time there, and how did you know it was time to leave?
There were a lot of meaningful moments. A couple of stories I did with Tom Ford were really meaningful because he brought a lot of respect to fashion in Los Angeles by, you know, eventually ending up here. And I think that's really kind of the through line of everything that I've been trying to do in my career, is just to sort of bring respect to what happens out here. And that's been interesting to watch, is just sort of the opinion people have of Los Angeles and how that's changed, and even how the culture in the city has changed. But, you know, I mean, I was covering Fashion Week here when it was like in back alleys and, you know, and like, you know, weird shows and whatever. And, you know, then also when, you know, Dior came to have the Cruise collection in Calabasas. So yeah. I think it's been a wide span of things, but it did take a while. I mean, when I first started covering the shows in Europe, I got in screaming matches with a couple of publicists who, you know, didn't want to give seats to the LA Times at shows. And it was, you know, I had to sort of fight that battle for respect. And then, you know, sure enough, like a couple of years after that battle, the designer in question would be opening a store in Los Angeles, yeah, right. You know? So yeah, it's been interesting to see that evolution and to kind of hopefully have been a bit of a part of it.
How did you know it was time to leave? And were you afraid to leave? People don't talk about transition.
I was afraid to leave. I guess I was. I mean, the thing that was sad about the LA Times is it sort of went through such a roller coaster of owners and mismanagement, and at a very crucial time in newspaper history, because, you know, I believe it sort of, because of the different owners and all the, you know, tumult, like it sort of lost some years in modernizing, and now is kind of having to play catch up a bit, and, you know, certainly has a new local owner now, which seems to be very positive. But for me, it was just like death by a thousand cuts. I mean, we had launched the image section and, you know, I was really proud of that. I was the first editor of the image section, and, you know, our first issue had Chloe Sevigny on the cover. And, you know, again, we had Victoria Beckham. We had an amazing, you know, really robust coverage, I think, of the fashion scene here. And then, you know, almost, I think, 6 months after the section had launched and, you know, it had been a financial success, they started laying people off. So to, you know, to have hired this entire staff of amazing people and then to sort of see them all picked off and then, you know, ended up being, you know, one of two people left at the end, that was really hard. And then, you know, when they said, we don't want to send you to the shows anymore, I was kind of like, well,
what's the point?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's like something that's, I mean,
fundamental.
We can debate like the future of fashion shows and whether they're necessary and whatnot. But yeah, that it's kind of like, if you don't go to the show, you're not in it. So I had a really good, you know, opportunity to take a package to be paid for a year and leave. And so I did. And it was actually a good thing because it gave me the opportunity to do some books and some freelance writing and then eventually to get another job where I learned a lot of new skills.
In that year, did you write the two books?
I had started the Juicy Couture book before I left.
Three books you've written.
The Juicy Couture book came out before I left, but the shopping book and American Runway, I wrote back to back in that year. And I finished American Runway actually after I started my job at the Hollywood Reporter. But
Was that a completely different way of writing?
The three books were very different. The Juicy Couture book was a business biography with Pam and Gila about how they built Juicy into a $200 million business.
Oh my God.
And, you know, they are hilarious people. They, you know, are best friends. They have a million stories. So a lot of that was kind of about corralling them into a place where we could kind of focus, and then taking all of their thoughts and putting it into something that was like easy to digest and had some service element to it. It was a lot of fun. It was, you know, I think it was well received. They ended up going on and selling it to a production company. So, you know, it could someday be a TV show, but yeah. Who knows?
The shopping. You want them to play themselves because they're so hilarious.
Oh, I know. It's like, who else could do it? The shopping book was really like leaning on all of my connections through the years and asking people where they love to shop. And it was fun. You know, honestly, I wish I could have like gone to all the places that they mentioned. I wish I could have, you know, yeah, I feel like that was one sort of bummer. And then in the American Runway book, I mean, it really sort of, I think, brought together a lot of my experience, particularly since it focused on how the runway has changed in the last, you know, few years, what I just referenced, and become part of pop culture and also become a lot more tied to entertainment. So as an LA person writing it, I felt like I had an interesting vantage point.
Can you tell me your three favorite stores in the world?
Well, yours, of course.
No. I mean, I'm a shopper, you know, like I love great retail, and yeah, it's sort of hard to find.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know what your faves are.
No, definitely. I mean, I think that there's probably one in every city. I mean, and sometimes they're like the more random or whatever, the better. I mean, in LA, honestly, there's this boutique called Govinda's, which is above the Hare Krishna temple in Culver City.
No, I've never heard of this.
You know, every sort of Indian garment you'd ever want, from saris to caftans to, you know, tunics.
Love.
Which is really fun and very, you know, yeah, kind of only in LA or India maybe, but you know, and then
what about in Paris?
In Paris, I mean, the Bon Marché. I can't.
Me too.
Yeah, it's too
unbeatable.
Good. Although I actually liked it more pre-renovations. I have this thing about all these department stores renovating, but maybe it's just because I'm nostalgic. But and then the Dries Van Noten store.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, is incredible. And then yeah, another sort of Indian place called Simran is.
Oh, also I love MSX. Simran.
Yeah, aww. That's really fun to go to. So yeah, and then I'm trying to think where else. London, I love going to Liberty.
I love
just because it's so old school. And then there's I try not to do fast fashion that much, but there's one that H&M has now called Arket, which is Arket, which is on Regent Street and really has like sort of the Celine vibes going, and they also have them in I think in Sweden, but yeah, I haven't found an Arket. I don't think there are any others in Europe yet.
So just in London,
or in that they're in Paris yet or Italy. So
all right, I'm gonna look it up.
Yeah.
So Hollywood Reporter and then West Coast editor for Women's Wear Daily.
Yeah.
I mean, had you always been a fan of women's wear?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it is
it's sort such of
the Bible.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
The Bible. And, you know, it's funny because I had read John Fairchild's Chic Savages a number of years ago. And then when I got this job, I reread it. And I do think that he had such a spirit and a sense of humor about covering the industry that I really admire and sort of try to keep in mind when I'm writing. Just, yeah, the hilarity that of it all. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's been a great experience. And Hollywood Reporter was difficult place to work, but it was a great experience because I got a lot of digital experience from that. I ran our style vertical and also really admire as an organization their ability to jump on news in like a second's notice and turn around a story and all that. And a memory I have of doing, you know, I was writing there for the, you know, through the Trump election and the first few months after that. And I remember writing about, this is another thing that I learned has become, you know, such a phenomenon that I learned at the Hollywood Reporter, is writing about social media. And Ivanka Trump had posted a picture of herself at going to a gala on the same day that her father was talking about a controversial policy about refugees. And she had this like tinfoil dress on, and it was silver metallic rather. And a lot of people were comparing it on social media to the tinfoil capes or coverings that are sadly given to refugees. And, you know, so that kind of thing, I mean, yes, it's a gotcha moment, but, you know, that kind of has become part of fashion reporting too, is kind of looking at how people are reacting to images online, and it can become a scandal.
Yeah. Melania's famous coat.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Will you talk a little bit about the state of fashion and maybe start with Barney's? Like, how did we get here? It's so sad.
Barney's. So, I mean, again, I feel like there is this, these stores think that they need to do all these renovations. And
like, what does a renovation do? I don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know.
Especially that one.
I know. I'm not sure that was a wise use of funds. But, you know, I mean, it's... If you look at the statistics, I mean, obviously, you know, people are shopping a lot more online. You have to give them a reason to come into the store. Yeah. You have to create an experience. A community is, I think, even more important. And I think that, you know, we're sort of seeing like a changing of the guard. I'm not necessarily sure we're seeing, you know, it's going to be like the end of brick and mortar retail. I just think it's like, you know, people are now embracing and believing in new brands. I mean, I think it's interesting to look at Gap and Everlane, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, both companies from the Bay Area, both sort of in the basics business. Everlane, a bit more expensive and, you know, dedicated since day one to, you know, their definition of transparency as far as giving shoppers a look into the factories where they make things, and also trying to incorporate sustainable materials as much as possible. You know, started off as a direct to consumer brand and obviously created a loyal community online. You know, now they're opening brick and mortar stores.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it's conceivable that Everlane could be just like Gap in 20 years, sure, as far as the number of stores. But, you know, the thing is it has different values than Gap. And as much as Gap now is trying to, you know, tell a sustainable story and sort of, you know, do their own thing with that, I mean, that hasn't been their story since day one. So I think it's, you know, it's more less a matter of like, this is, you know, end times for retail than just a matter of like, there's a reinvention, and a changing of the guard.
And what about runway shows and sort of that whole, since you wrote a book on it?
The runway shows, it's like, you can't hardly believe they're still going on.
I know.
They are just so, wasteful and inefficient and, and just like the amount of time. I mean, I'm away from home for 2 months a year.
Yeah.
So
I know,
you know, it's absurd, really. And especially in this day and age where like time is really the biggest luxury. And, you know, these shows are ostensibly created for media, which, you know, is imploding. So how many people, media, are there to even go to the shows? That being said, it's, you know, there's nothing like a fashion show. There's nothing like, it's really hard to make any kind of judgment about clothes if you can't see them in person, at least as the technology exists now. You know, and I think that more and more at the WWD CEO Summit a couple weeks ago, we had Kirby John Raymond speak from the brand Pyer Moss. And he said, you know, fashion, the business of selling product in fashion is over. It's all about selling experiences and selling and tribalism, he said. And I think that's really true, and that these live events do create communities and tribes and excitement for brands. I'm not sure that they need to be on a Fashion Week schedule the way that they have been. I mean, certainly if you look at the success of what Kanye's been doing with Sunday Services, for example, you know, that has nothing to do with Fashion Week. And I think a lot of designers are also realizing that, you know, especially young designers, they're selling merch off their experiences almost more than they're selling actual clothes.
Right.
I mean, Kirby John Raymond said that for his last Pierre Moss show, he sold more in merch than the actual collection.
That's so, well, I mean, and same with recording artists. I mean, that's, it's not even about concerts. It's about selling merch around the concerts. That is so weird.
Yeah, I know. So I feel like, you know, fashion events are not going to go away, or fashion shows, but I feel like sort of the expected format is not as interesting to people anymore. And, you know, sadly, you can kind of see it from online engagement and numbers of fashion shows. I mean, people just aren't reading about them or looking at them as much anymore, unless there's an added element. For example, the last New York Fashion Week, I believe it was Ralph Lauren's show that got the most hits and engagement because he had Janelle Monáe perform.
Yeah.
And he created this whole like Ralph's Club, you know, environment. So, you know, I think that, again, it really makes it hard for young designers who are kind of trying to compete on in that exact same way during that time frame of a fashion week.
Interesting. We, in our store too, I've never had more interest in trunk shows in my whole career.
Yeah.
And we have probably two a week, and people just, they go nuts.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's some LA designers I know that's the only way they sell.
Right.
Is they kind of go around the country and they have small events. And again, that speaks to this need for community and this need for kind of a personal experience with a designer.
Right.
That I think, yeah, the best stores are kind of getting into being able to be a platform for that.
It sounds like wisdom and patience and resilience have been some of your most, your strongest qualities. Which one do you think has served you best, and what's gotten you through through your career, I guess?
Yeah, I don't think my husband would agree that I'm patient. I tend to kind of lose my temper sometimes, but I think that just maybe resilience. I think that just sort of feeling like you belong in the room and that you deserve the same treatment as everyone else, or you deserve an answer, or you deserve a front row seat, or whatever it is, I think is an important quality in fashion, because there's so many forces that are trying to kind of hold you down and whatever. And it's funny, because I think when I was young, I was kind of like maybe a bit delusional about myself. I mean, I remember sort of the first times going to the fashion shows, and there would be like empty front row seats, and I'd be like, well, I'm just going to sit there. No one's sitting there, you know? And like sometimes they would come and it would be embarrassing or whatever. But, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, some of that is maybe silly or presumptuous, but some of it's good, you know, because it's kind of like, you can't be intimidated, and you have to sort of always have ambition that you're going to be the best, or that you're trying to be the best. Because yeah, I mean, you have to sort of convince people and prove yourself along the way.
I also think it sounds like you really knew what you wanted. And I think most people don't really know what they want, you know?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I'm not sure I was like, I'm not sure I knew exactly what I wanted. Like, I want to be the first fashion critic at the LA Times. I just wanted to be good at what I do. And I think, you know, it's like, for me, if you're not going to do something well, it's not really worth doing. You know, that's, I think, just kind of having always that sort of striver ambition type thing maybe has served me well, but maybe, I don't know. It served me well career-wise, but, you know, who knows, like happiness-wise.
What does success look like for you now?
That's so funny. It's
like because you look successful.
Oh, thank you.
Do you feel successful?
Not really. And I feel, you know, that's like, you know, question for the psychiatrist couch. But I feel like, I don't know. I feel like it's success for me is just kind of like one story after the next. I mean, it's kind of like, okay, I'll reread that. And you know what? That was good. I did a good job. Or, you know, or even success could be, I had a really tough time with this, you know, fashion week, or, you know, some things that discouraged me, but I made it through. And, you know, I didn't cry.
What's your tolerance for risk?
I don't really have, I don't have much. I wish I had way more, because then I would be an entrepreneur, or I'd own my own fashion store like you do.
Don't do it. You know,
or something. Yeah. I mean, I'm constantly amazed, you know, years after, like, of all the people I've written about who've started their own things. And I wish I had that, you know, tolerance for risk and just that everything was going to be okay, but I don't. Yeah, it's funny. I remember I was the first person to write about Tom's Shoes, and Blake Mycoskie, who founded it. And, you know, it's like he called me and he's like, I have these little, like, you know, espadrilles that I, you know, and you just think, like, really, you know, it's, you know, but Charlize Theron was wearing them, and, you know, and sure enough, he created this huge empire. But I mean, just to me, to have the confidence in yourself that you're going to actually create the next great t-shirt line, like, I wish I had that. Like, you know, what are the odds that you're really going to create the next great t-shirt line? Yeah. But, you know, people do it day after day, and kudos to them. You know, I'll be happy to write about it. But sadly, yeah, I don't have the courage to do it.
I think you've had a really interesting seat to watch, actually, all this whole fashion change over the last 30 years.
Yeah.
30?
Yeah. Well, maybe 25.
25. Yeah, yeah, I am older. But it's so completely different, isn't it, from when you started?
Yeah. It's very
every
entrepreneurial.
Part of it.
Yeah. I feel like we are living in sort of this really entrepreneurial age, which is exciting. And young people are starting things all the time. And, you know, and then they also don't feel like they don't think they're going to be locked into something forever, which is very different, since I feel like I've sort of, you know, more or less been doing the same thing for 25 years. So.
Doing it well.
Oh, thank you.
How do you think LA fashion is viewed now?
I mean, it's like we can't stop New Yorkers from moving out here.
Exactly.
It's an influx. But it's a great place to be, because I feel like in fashion right now, everything's really converging. Entertainment, technology, music, art. And LA has all of those industries.
And sunshine. Ask everybody in the podcast what they wore to prom. Did Chapin have a prom?
Chapin didn't have a prom. No, I know. And it's funny, because in subsequent years afterward, they did and whatever. But yeah, we had various dances that were inter school things.
And do you have
probably
a favorite?
Probably a Victor Costa. Yeah, I was all about
what, like, color? Strapless?
It was a, like, a hot pink fuchsia, which is still my favorite color. Mini dress with short sleeves that was, like, off the shoulder. And, you know, like a column, and then it had rhinestone buttons up the front, which, yeah, would that I still had that dress or could fit into it. I would, yeah.
Victor Costa was the man.
I know. I mean, basically, I think
we must be the same age.
He was kind of a bit of a copyist, I think people might say, but you know, it wasn't like I was going to be wearing Oscar de la Renta.
Right, exactly.
So, anyway.
Thank you so much, Booth. Loved having you.
This was really fun. Thanks for having me.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda. What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.